Okay, ladies and gentlemen, is that clear? Yeah? If we begin again then with the main bit of the evening. So just to alert you that because, especially with this layout, it can be hard for people at the back to hear, we're going to use the microphones, okay? So Don's got his on anyway, and Will, standing up, with a smiley t-shirt on, and I will roam about to bring them to you. If you haven't used these before, they're directional, so there's no point in that, it will not have any effect. You have to point them at your mouth and fairly close, but don't put them right up, otherwise it will get a bit wrong. Okay, so a couple of inches away and pointing at you is perfect. And if we can just use that so that it just makes it a little bit easier. Is that a way for the first question? Yeah? Go on.
Could be.
You mentioned that these chemicals are not particularly effective on humans. There's no strong correlation for cancer. Have we in fact developed evolutionary, because we've had cooked food for probably half a million years, maybe longer, I don't know, and animals, of which some of the base tested one, have not had an evolutionary lifetime on cooked foods.
That was it's a very good point, and that was an argument that was being put forward. The counter argument to that is those foods that contain the most acrylamide, coffee, crisps, chips, we haven't been eating for that long. So we might have been exposed to low levels in bread and in baking of bread. I think probably baking a bread would be the major one, because potatoes. You see, we've only had potatoes for 500 years, haven't we? And potatoes are the biggest source of anybody. Well, you've got some data in front of you, are the biggest source of acrylamide. So I think there might be a little bit in that, but do remember the levels of exposure would have been, to 100 years ago, would have been a lot less than they are now.
If I eat said crisp,
don't do it.
How quickly will my body get rid of it, or does it accumulate?
And it goes into the blood. We know it's absorbed into the bloodstream, and there it forms an adduct with hemoglobin.
Sorry, what's an adduct?
An addition compound with hemoglobin. So it attaches itself. It attaches itself to hemoglobin.
Yeah.
And so it remains in the bloodstream attached to hemoglobin. And in fact, that is one of the mechanisms by which then its subsequent release from the hemoglobin as a slightly different compound that then might form an adduct again, an addition compound with DNA. Mm. Addition compound with hemoglobin, then it's reversible. Hemoglobin turnover is quite rapid, and it is reversible. However, if it forms an adduct with DNA, then that could be a little bit more serious. Which is why I think on one of my slides I said that it has been found as in animals as an adduct onto DNA. It's been shown to modify DNA. At the moment, nobody has been able to show that in any human samples they've taken. So I think that's quite a key to it.
Thank
you.
Can you understand? Can you explain the difference between the caramelization reaction and the Maillard reaction? Do they overlap? Are they different? Are they same? I'm totally confused about the two.
Caramelization is a sugar on its own. When you heat a sugar, preparing a toffee, then you heat it to quite a high temperature, water is released, and then you start to get the brown colours and the very characteristic flavour. If you add a little bit of ammonia to that, which is a nitrogen compound, then you will get caramelization occurring a lot more readily. And a lot of the caramels that are used as colours in foods, quite a number of them, are ammonia caramels, where they add a little bit of ammonia to the sugar and heated it. If you add an amino acid to the sugar, the same thing will apply, that you will get the reaction occurs a lot more readily, because you can almost think of the amino acid acting as a catalyst, helping to break down the sugar into sugar products. The difference, then we start to get differences. because the caramelisation stops at principally sugar breakdown products. And I did, in fact, on one of the diagrams show a few of those. But if you have an amino acid there, that will then interact with those breakdown products to give you further reactions. And that's what flavour is. That's what flavour in a heated food is.
And that's the Maillard reaction.
That's the Maillard reaction. So the Maillard reaction is when you have an amino compound, usually an amino acid, reacting with the sugar. So if you think about it, that's going to apply in just about any food. Unless you... The only one it doesn't apply is, of course, if you're just making toffee and you've only got sugar there. But if you have... Any food has got amino acids and sugars there. So you might say, well, it is so important in meat flavour. And you say, well, there isn't much sugar in meat. You know, sugar's got lots of protein there. Has it got... meat's got lots of protein there. Has it got sugars? Well, of course it has. Because you have sugar in your bloodstream to make your muscles work. But also, you have got ribonucleotides, building blocks of cells, which contain a particularly very important sugar, ribose. So any food that we have has got sugars and amino acids. Heat that food up above 100 degrees and you're going to get lovely flavours and colours. Some of those foods might give you a bit of acrylamide, but forget about the acrylamide bit. Enjoy our food.
We'll come over here. I was just going to say, presumably the fact that a lot of cooking techniques now is a addition of very sugary and fruity flavours while cooking is perhaps going to enhance the mild reactions and the flavours a bit more.
That is part of the idea. Yeah. Yes.
You haven't said anything about smoked food and also barbecued food.
Yes, I did mention those.
And also bacon. I thought bacon had a part.
No. You've mentioned foods, smoked food, the smoke, barbecued foods and cured meats. All of those reactions could produce carcinogens, but not the acrylamide. So they're different ones. And we've known for quite a few years that barbecued meats, you get a reaction occurring related to these Maillard reactions. You get a reaction occurring there that will produce some compounds that are known to be carcinogenic, heterocyclic aromatic amines, HHAs. So that has been a big problem in the meat, considered a problem in the meat industry. It's a relatively easy one to solve because you just have to be careful on the barbecue that you don't actually make it too light, too dark.
And you mustn't add sugar to the sugary... sauces and things.
That wouldn't make very much difference. No.
What about smoked?
Smoke, then again, that will come in the barbecue. But smoke.
Like smoked salmon, smoked meat.
And that is.
Smoked bacon.
That is potentially an issue because smoke does contain some potentially carcinogenic compounds. Benzpyrene is the name of that class of compounds, and those are present in smoke. And therefore, and naturally a smoked food could have traces of these compounds there. And I think the jury's out on that. The cured meat, then that's because you add a chemical called sodium nitrite to the curing, which helps to give you that lovely pink colour. The cured meat is pink, and it's also pink when you cooked it. No other meat, all other meats are brown and even browner when you cook, red, brown, and even brown when you cook bacon, isn't and ham. But that sodium nitrite can again react with natural components in the food to give you potentially carcinogenic compounds.
But not acrylamide.
No, acrylamide, and that's why those foods are different. Acrylamide is really with these sorts of foods. You see, I don't mind eating.
Yep, done.
Christmas.
Smoky Christmas.
Before I go, asparagus, I like very much with grilled with butter. Presumably, that is rather toxic, I would imagine.
Yes, it is.
Well, possibly. But I don't think, I think if you cooked asparagus to the extent that would be necessary, so that it was very brown on the outside, it wouldn't be very edible. So I don't, but of course that's where the word asparagine comes from asparagus, because that's where the amino acid was first discovered.
But actually, so I mean, are asparagus a dangerous food for us to eat then?
Well, no, because you're eating asparagine, not acrylamide.
Yes.
Yes, if you minced up the asparagus and then tried to put it into a thin layer, made a crisp out of it.
Yes.
Possibly.
Would.
But why?
I think some food scientists
should do that. I think
you're
a bit sick
that.
If you're going to do that.
Yeah, that's okay.
Want to go to the back? We'll never come to the front.
Because we're talking about sort of big business in the food industry, did financial considerations come into effect when the strategy for reducing the amount of acrylamide was used?
In that, did they try and find shortcuts?
No, did they go for the cheapest method first? And if so, when you're showing the reduction in the acrylamide, are they now at a stage of having to use a different strategy to get a further reduction?
Yeah, I see what you mean. Possibly. On the other hand, they would go for the simplest method first, which would also be the cheapest, and that would be, could we lower the time and temperature at which we cook the food and still get that same or very similar food product? So that was the initial approach. That only got them a certain distance. So then there was the suggestion, I mentioned asparaginase, this enzyme that would break down asparagine. That's expensive, and so that's going to be less likely to be used. One, because of expense, but also it's a fermentation step, so that might be all right in fermented cakes and maybe some biscuits products, but we know using the potato products or something like that. But I know the industry is putting a lot of money into the long-term solutions, which are through varietal selection. I expect that in 20 years they will be thinking about using genetically modified because of the information that becomes available. And that will occur in the States long before it ever comes here. But we'll have another generation then who will perhaps look at that subject slightly differently from our generation. But they're certainly putting a lot of resource into variety. One thing I didn't mention with potatoes is that potatoes, of course, we store. Because potatoes aren't available all the year. So the crops are, by this time of year, we're starting to, we're still using up last year's potatoes. They've been in store. And you don't want them to sprout. You don't want to germinate, because then they're no use as a potato. If you store at low temperature, sort of, 3 or 4 degrees, then you'll know this if you put it in your own fridge of potato, then you don't get the sprouting, or it takes a long time. The trouble is, that causes breakdown of starch to give glucose. So those potatoes have got more glucose. So potatoes that are last year's crop, that are probably on the new crops now, but you know, a couple of months ago on the last year's crop would probably have a lot of sugar in. And so that's something they're trying to approach as well. How can we store our potato without, at a higher temperature, so that we don't get sugar? But how do we do it without sprouting?
We'll go up to the front here. Can I just ask
if
you find your
own
palm? Just a bit closer, because
my talking.
That's perfect.
You missed all my
talking. That's all right. Somebody at the front here.
In the case of bread, if you cut the crusts off, do you cut the acrylamide off?
Yeah.
But in the case of roast potatoes, if you keep them well basted so they don't get dry, do you stop the acrylamide form?
No, you won't. No, because the basting would be the fat, wouldn't it? Which will be at quite a high temperature. So, if you boil the potatoes, you'll be quite all right.
Can't have roast potatoes.
Um, I was told that the humans had a very good DNA repair mechanism built in. So maybe we should rely on that a bit.
Yes, I think that's a very positive point.
We've learned quite a lot about acrylamide in food, which is good. I just wonder whether you might put it into context, I mean, your knowledge of foods in general. What food should we really be worried about?
No, I think the Food Standard Agency, if you look on their website, will tell you that what you want is a balanced diet. That, you know, a diet that's only fruit and vegetable, you'll be denying yourselves quite a lot of essential vitamins and you're going to have difficulty getting enough protein. On the other hand, a protein-only diet will cause you other health problems. We want the fruits there because of these natural antioxidants that are in fruits. So, a balanced diet. Now, everybody says that we should not be eating so much fast food, which is probably right, but I don't think there's any harm in having the odd McDonald's burger. I think if you have McDonald's burger you know, every day of the week, and maybe twice a day, and I think there may be some people who do that, then I don't think that's good. Partly, not so much because of the acrylamide intake, but because of the high saturated fat intake. Also, too much sugar will cause problems like I've got. I haven't got the diabetes yet, but if I keep on eating as much sugar, this is going to get even bigger, and then I will start getting those problems. Although, I've decided my problem here is nothing to do with what I eat and no exercise. It's called the menopause, the male menopause.
Excuses.
I have a question. Why is this, do we know why reduced soil salt content increases the asparagine content of plants?
Yeah, we think we do. That plant is under a lot of stress. But its whole purpose of the plant growing is to produce seeds and as much growth as it can. So it's deprived of its main nitrogen source. So it stores up the amino acids because it's not growing properly, so it stores up the amino acids. We think that the role of the sulfur isn't, it's not a sulfur amino acid, only two of those, and that's not the other one. We think that it probably affects the enzymes, and some of the important enzymes have sulfur in them, and those enzymes are not present or severely depleted in the absence of sulfur. So the reason why the growth is stunted is probably because it's not been able to produce enough enzymes, but at the same time it tries to compensate by producing as much new nitrogen as it can.
So if you're going to grow your own plants to eat, then you want to make sure there's a decent sulfate content.
Yes. But, so sulfur fertilisation on the soil is a good idea.
Here's the middle there and then back here.
Is the asparagine incorporated into plant proteins?
Yes. Yeah, the nitrogen. The nitrogen is. The extra asparagine's got two nitrogens on it, so it's got more nitrogens on it than most other amino acids, and you need that to incorporate into making all the amino acids that will make all the protein. We don't biosynthesize them, not many of our amino acids. We take them in, yep. Whereas plants, of course, generate them.
Thing that I've discovered myself as a bad cook. If you take broccoli and you boil it, it has a very distinctive smell and taste. If you then put that in the oven, it browns, and the taste and the smell are completely different.
Useful tip.
Completely different, and much, much tastier and much nicer.
You haven't tried that for me, have you, Angela? Broccoli. Broccoli, actually roasting it. Roasting it in the oven.
I've never given you broccoli or onions, but you don't like
them. I detest broccoli.
You might like it this one.
Yeah, if you...
I know the smells you mean. Now, there are a couple of reasons why those
there's
smells...
There's a chemical disappear. Reaction there, definitely.
But also, the compound, because you can smell the compounds, they're fairly volatile, they go into the air quite readily.
But the taste is completely different.
The taste, the taste is compounds called glucosinolates that are present in broccoli and some of those other related vegetables. And I know there is work going on, can we get... varieties of broccoli that have lower levels of these compounds.
Are they bad
for you? Glucosinolates.
Isn't that one where some people taste them as genuinely nasty? It's a genetic trait, isn't it? You either like them or you hate them.
There's an element of that, and it's to do with how many taste buds you have all the time. And it's to do with our mechanisms of taste, and so they do trigger that. I don't think they're harmful. But the idea is that if you could genuinely produce, particularly broccoli and some of the other similar related vegetables, with less glucosinolates, they might become more acceptable. And there are, people have been looking at different varieties that would have lower levels. So it's partly, I'm not quite sure why the taste would disappear. It could only be that it's being covered up by some other compounds. The smell, and it's as much the smell that I don't like. The smell I can understand going because the smell is volatile, it readily goes in the air, and you put it into a very hot oven, it evaporates.
But when you bake it, almost burn it, the taste and the smell are completely different.
Because you generated lots of different chemical compounds in that process. So that, as you do if you roast potatoes, the surface, as you bake bread,
acrylamide
might be, but acrylamide doesn't have taste or smell.
Can I ask, has anybody tested bagels for acrylamide levels? Because isn't that a form of bread where you actually boil them? Isn't that right?
I think the browning they put on, boil them or steam them, yeah, they're still toasted a bit because they're brown on the outside but I would suggest that just looking at bagels would not have as much acrylamide.
Okay, but nobody's tested that.
They might have done, because people have looked at just about everything you could imagine.
Have you heard of the cronut?
New York has been crazy, cross between a croissant and a donut.
There's a lot of frying involved in that. I suspect the acrylamide may be.
And therefore, it's a temperature. The frying gives you... The fat doesn't produce it. The fat gives you the means of the temperature being transferred into the product.
So if nobody else has put their hand up, I'll carry on. Does anybody know if... It's probably a difficult experiment to run, but do we know if acrylamide itself has a flavour, or would it be too dangerous to taste?
It has been tasted.
Has it? Okay.
Yes, because when people didn't... asparagine has, whether acrylamide has.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
But the main judge of that is, does it smell? And it doesn't have a smell. Something as volatile as that. A taste, it's unlikely to have very much taste because of the size and the shape of the molecule. Its taste is going to be similar to that of other amino acids, because it's derived from those amino acids.
So given that I every year teach my first years the structure of monosodium glutamate, which is only a small bit bigger, which of course is a massive flavour of cancer, doesn't have a taste of its own, it helps its flavour.
It does. It contributes very much to your umami taste.
Yeah.
But monosodium glutamate is in all foods.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm just saying that size may not necessarily be relevant to flavour.
No.
That's a good example of another small molecule for flavour.
I don't think anybody has specifically tasted acrylamide. I don't think I would even my worst students, I wouldn't put on that panel.
Any other comments or questions or points? Unusually, I suspect we will draw to a slightly early close, but if I know this audience, there'll be a couple of people coming up to ask you if there's anything else. to talk about. And can I urge everyone to keep Don amused while we clear up, because we're going to take them out to dinner. So it takes a little bit of time to get all the wine glasses and things like that washed. Thank you very, very much, everybody. Next month is again the second Tuesday of the month, and that is Professor Philip Hutchinson on... effectively, he hasn't given me an exact title yet, but it's effectively, is CO2 really the enemy in climate change? Which I suspect may be interesting. He was originally due to speak in January, and then we switched the date. And to say that we'll be back in September in whichever venue, so that you know it is likely that it will be the backup venue I have planned, which we're booked into, which is the visitor centre at the University Museum, or as a lot of kids call it, the Dinosaur Museum. If it isn't, though, the reason will be because I've found somewhere better. So that's our backup. I am exploring this one particular place I'm looking at, but I don't know if they're even able to take us, or willing to do it at the right time for us. And we'll just have to see how that goes. I will definitely announce it on the mailing list. If you aren't subscribed, it's a good idea. It's on the left of the flyers. Just to say also that a few people may have noticed the link to the domain name for our website's gone askew.
Yes.
I haven't tracked down why. But again, I pushed out on the mailing list as soon as I noticed that the site is still very much there. I put the direct link to it in. It's going to carry on being there. That won't disappear. So just use the direct link for updates at the moment. And I am updating Twitter and Facebook as well, which again are linked off that site. And fairly easy to find if you Google Oxford Café Sylt Beek. So we will definitely be carrying on. Nothing on that's going to stop. We're not actually part of Science Oxford. So nothing is going to change just moving to new premises. Which ones they will be, I'll definitely announce at the last cafe of the summer, which is going to be next month. And then, as regulars will know, we always take a break in August after the first year, when several people came up and said, you're not allowed to have one when in August, we want to go on holiday, please. So we decided it was a good idea generally, plus also my helpers have quite often vanished at that point in the year to have their own holidays, so it works well. We will be back on the second Tuesday of September. And like last year, I will hope to have all the talks in place by then, so everyone will know who's coming every month. So I think that's all my general announcements. As you'll see from the various leaflets and things, Science Oxford, although it's publicly no longer open on Saturdays, is still running a few events and quite a lot of stuff going on. So if you're interested, have a look. And other than that, thank you very much, and a particularly big thank you to Don for coming forward tonight. If anyone wants the last few crisps, they're very welcome.
We only worked it, and we, well, nobody else would be doing it. We happen to have developed some very, very badly said. This
I don't think too much of enhancing levels beyond certain levels about anything is not a good idea. But it is actually true.
Which hall were you in? You must
say. I was never in hall.
I thought in Phoenix. I was in Devon. Yeah. Devonshire Hall for 3 years. Quite well.
Yes, I had a really good time. I came up from the sinful south.
And the American broccoli.
So they
were not hated. No, okay. No, we never.
So I don't suppose we ever had joined
that. That's the kind of thing you say after you finish.
Yeah. Chemistry was not this small.
Was it associated with leather science?
They decided that there was no future in learning to food. But ours was textiles. Somebody I graduated with contacted me 6 or 7 years ago. I don't know the time it was on the television, but we got together. And I said, it's coming up to 40 years since we graduated. Do you know any other people? By the time we finished, we had gone 12 out of the 16 of the year. And we all went back to the interview. And we've done it 3 times.
What was he talking about?
He said, nobody's changed.
That's the thing. That's very nice of you, thank you. I do.
Especially if you're taking us both out to dinner,
you
can't.
We haven't talked about sponsorship, which is great. So the Oxford Bioscience Network, OBN, has sponsored us for the last 2 years. Cheating, really, because it's through a friend of mine who's the main CEO. So he's very keen on this. I do invite a lot of people. I'm very lucky. Specialise in different things, which is really helpful. So I can invite people from all over, but I have to say, I mean, it's funny, when I finally kind of got myself together in London, I realised realised you've been on my list of people for a very long time, but I suspect it may have been a good thing to tell me to tell you emeritus. People are usually less busy.
Well, yeah, I wish that was the my wife wishes that was the case.
Yeah. I find it varies, so sometimes emeritus scientists keener because they no longer have so many students.
Yeah, we readily get out of touch. On the other hand, just before I came out, I just wrote a proposal for a company to do some work on a film.
There's lots of public interest in it, having just done it happen.
Tom says, tables and chairs to the side.
Nothing really stark, do they?
They do, actually.
Some of them are stark. Maybe they do.
I thought so. Most of your handouts have vanished. People do like a good handout.
Just over to the side anyway.
Oh, please don't worry about it. We're just going around to do it fast. Did you tell Lizzie to come back up as soon as everything's done downstairs, will
you? I didn't actually tell her.
But you think she will?
Yeah, we'll be going out.
The best thing to do is to go out the back way, then we can pop everything in our cars, including me and mine.
Yeah.
And then we'll just walk around the corner.
So when we go out, we'll pop.
Yeah.
So pop it down.
How many did you have tonight?
34.
That's not so bad.
Oh,
yeah, exactly. For a quiet, you know, for a night you'd expect to be pretty quiet.
Do you still have your
lapel? No, I found it. I got it, yep. Yeah.